Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
People can leave the state now and teach and potentially make more money and pay a lot less for healthcare.
Two bills aim to change the way healthcare is offered to school district employees in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a Sitka man's invention to arrange luggage is sold to airlines around the world.
It's still enjoyable, and I think believing in what we're doing makes a big difference.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Construction season is here, Alaska. Avoid surprises on the drive. Before getting on your way, check 511 for traffic delays. For current traffic information and road conditions, visit 511.alaska.gov or download the app or call 511. For more detailed information about DOT construction projects, visit dot.alaska.gov/construction. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
An Anchorage resident filed a class action lawsuit this week seeking to force the State Division of Public Assistance to get cash assistance to vulnerable Alaskans in a timely manner. The Alaska Beacon reports Natalia Edwards filed her complaint with the civil rights firm Northern Justice Project. This class action lawsuit comes on the heels of a lawsuit filed against the Department of Health earlier this year. 10 Alaskans sued the state, saying the division's backlog caused an unlawfully long wait for food stamps. The backlog has kept thousands of Alaskans waiting on food stamps and Medicaid, but it's also affecting other programs the division manages, like adult public assistance, a cash benefit for elderly, blind, and disabled Alaskans. The state is legally required to process adult public assistance applications in 30 days. Data show that it's taking more than twice that long. A Department of Health spokesperson said the division has been making progress, but it isn't processing applications within a desirable time frame. Anchorage's largest homeless shelter might stay open past April 30th after all, in a limited capacity. 3 Anchorage Assembly members announced Wednesday that they will ask the full assembly next Tuesday to extend the Sullivan Arena's use as a shelter, specifically for people with the most severe mobility, mental health, and behavioral health issues. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant says this group has complex needs and nowhere else to go.
We're going to have to come up with a proposal that will allow them to stay for a short term at the Sullivan Arena or an alternative facility if the administration is able to identify one. This is the right and humane thing to do.
Anchorage's leaders have struggled with how and when to close the shelter at the Sullivan. The hockey arena was always meant to be a temporary shelter solution as more intentional shelter and housing alternatives became available, but progress on those fronts has been slow, particularly for low-barrier shelters. The Assembly previously set April 30th as the deadline to close the Sullivan shelter, and they're scrambling to find places for people to go. For weeks, the Assembly's shelter consultant, Kathleen McLaughlin, has recommended the Sullivan be stepped down, limiting its capacity to the highest need people past April 30th. She estimates there are about 174 people in that group. In total, about 350 people have been sleeping in the Sullivan, with another 100-plus using a warming area. The Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness hasn't taken a position on the proposal to step down capacity, but the coalition on Wednesday did advocate for keeping the Sullivan open one extra day. Meg Zalatel is the coalition's executive director and an assembly member.
So right now, April 30th is a Sunday. That's a little problematic because services aren't typically available on Sundays. And Sunday is just a really hard time to have any kind of support for people if they are going to be moving.
Zalatel says lessons learned from the abrupt closure of the Sullivan Arena shelter last year informed some ways to smooth the transition this year. She says there will be a pop-up event in the Sullivan's parking lot on April 26th to provide some basic necessities for people who will be camping outside, and targeted outreach to address food and water plans. The particulars of the extension proposals are still being worked on and are expected to be last-minute additions to the Assembly's regular agenda on Tuesday. University of Alaska Anchorage researchers have found antibiotic-resistant microbes in the feces of Anchorage moose. The Alaska Beacon reports that includes antibiotic-resistant E. coli and other microbes found in moose scat collected from locations throughout Anchorage, by waterways, in parks, residential neighborhoods, and parking lots near medical facilities. The fear is that microbes will sicken humans, possibly transmitted from their dogs, or that people experiencing homelessness camping outside will get sick, because many do not have access to clean water. Because the microbes have evolved to not respond to some types of antibiotics, the illnesses would be more difficult to treat. Antibiotic resistance has already caused health problems for some people in Anchorage. 6 Alaska hospital patients have been identified since the start of 2022 with serious infections of antibiotic-resistant pathogens, according to a recent bulletin from the State Division of Public Health's Epidemiology Section. A decade ago, antibiotic-resistant infections were linked to deaths of some Alaska hospital patients. It's estimated that more than 1,000 moose live in or walk through Anchorage. There's no sign that the presence of antibiotic-resistant microbes is causing any health problems for them. Alaska school districts are responsible for buying their own private insurance plans for staff, which are often expensive for districts and employees. But 2 bills working their way through the legislature would allow school districts and other state employee groups to opt into the state's health care plan, which proponents say could save them money and help with staff retention. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District spends about 16% of its budget on health insurance for employees, or about $22 million a year. Superintendent Clayton Holland says it's a cost that gets passed along to employees and is a major factor in the district's struggles to recruit and retain teachers.
People will come here and, you know, if there's a significant part of their paycheck that's going to health care, it's hard to keep them here. You know, if there are options that might have better health care or less expensive.
That phenomenon is compounded by stagnant education funding from the state. The base student allocation, the amount of money per student the state provides to districts, hasn't meaningfully increased since 2017 and is a major topic in the legislature this session.
People can leave the state now and teach and potentially make more money and pay a lot less for health care. So it impacts us for both recruitment and that retention piece.
A House bill sponsored by Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance and a companion Senate bill from Palmer Republican Senator Shelley Hughes would offer districts the option to address those woes by opting into the state's health care plan, currently used by state employees. Holland has been a supporter of both bills and submitted letters of support for each. He also testified this week before the House Labor and Commerce Committee while they heard Vance's version of the bill. Each district would have the choice of opting into the state plan or sticking with private coverage for all employees. Holland says ultimately, whether the Kenai district opts in will depend on collective bargaining with the staff associations. He says the legislature is projecting that the state plan would be a savings for the district, but he's still waiting on more data to know for sure. But Holland is supportive of having more options for health care.
The district pays 85% of healthcare costs, and our employees pick up the other 15%. So there's still a significant cost for employees. So anything we can do to potentially bring that down, we're interested in.
Vance's bill remains in the House Labor and Commerce Committee. The bill on the Senate side is currently being held in Senate Education. In Juneau, I'm Riley Board.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 23-year-old law student is recognized for his commitment to Indigenous culture.
Some of the greatest stories that you'll ever hear are told around a table set with Indigenous food.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Rogue dog packs in Petersburg used to be a problem. But for 15 years, the nonprofit Petersburg Humane Association has cared for the town's stray dogs and cats. And for the last decade, the organization has relied on a flock of non-native birds to help them do their work. KFSK's Rachel Cassandra joined director Mary Clements to witness this year's spring migration.
I had to scrape the windows this morning. It's a little icy.
It's 6 a.m. and we're in Mary Clements' silver station wagon driving to the pickup spot.
Some flockers like to do it at night. Come in at, you know, the dark of night and do it the night before. I'd just soon do it in the morning.
That guy looks a little hurt.
Yeah, he's a little droopy.
The bird's Latin name is Phoenicopterus ruber. And if you found them in the wild, they might sound like this. But these ones are made of plastic. Think classic pink flamingo lawn ornaments popular in 1960s Florida. Residents pay $10 for a flock of about 10 flamingos to visit a yard for the day.
When the flamingos come out, you know spring is here.
That's board member Laura Wong Rose. She says 15 years ago, Petersburg streets felt very different.
Apparently, we used to have packs of dogs roaming around town terrorizing children and a pretty large feral cat community.
The dogs were pooping all over downtown streets, attacking leashed dogs and hunting deer, giving chase until the deer died from exhaustion or fled into the water and drowned.
Apparently, it was kind of dangerous to go outside sometimes.
So a group of residents banded together to tackle the issue head-on, forming the Petersburg Humane Association. Wong Rose says the biggest way that the association helps with stray animals is through prevention.
We do that through offering spay-neutership scholarships.
Spaying or neutering a pet is not cheap, and Wong Rose says that COVID pushed up the price of the operations.
And so average spay or neuter can run anywhere, you know, in the $400 up to $1,200 range.
Petersburg Humane Association is independent, meaning it's not connected with any other humane associations. So they rely on two annual fundraisers to raise money. Besides flocking flamingos, they publish a yearly calendar with photos of Petersburg's pets. And Petersburg loves its pets. Local dog owners have, on average, 3 dogs per household, according to Wong Rose.
A lot of dogs in town, and the dog population is increasing, it seems.
The association maintains a dog park near the beach with volunteer help, and they run a no-kill shelter. Volunteers help care for puppies and kittens, and the organization keeps a list of families willing to foster animals temporarily.
Yeah. So this is the place I'm going to turn around up here.
Clemens and I pull up in her car to the house where the flamingos will loiter all day. We close the car doors silently so we don't ruin the surprise.
I like to be kind of quiet.
It's a lawn with a chain link fence around it on Nordic Avenue, a main street in Petersburg.
This is a perfect yard because every place I push them down, they're going in. So sometimes it's not so easy to find places to stick them, but this is it's working out just great.
The two flamingo flocks will migrate around Petersburg through the end of April. And then they'll disappear as suddenly as they appeared, signaling spring is really here. In Petersburg, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
An airplane equipment manufacturer is setting up shop in Sitka in the garage where he invented his first device. Tim Fulton is a ramper who spent nearly 4 decades loading luggage and cargo on Alaska Airlines jets. After weathering the pandemic and several years of demonstrating his product around the world and obtaining various safety certifications, he'll be shipping his first 2 orders this month. KCAW's Robert Woolsey dropped by to see how business is shaping up at Ramper Innovations.
If you are experiencing deja vu right now, don't be concerned. I've reported on Ramper Innovations on 2 previous occasions, first with Tim Fulton, the innovator, a second time with Tim Fulton, the product developer. This third trip is to meet with Tim Fulton, the manufacturer, and to see his operation. Fulton's machinist, Dane Invest, is operating a computer-controlled router.
What's this part that's being made?
It's a cover plate for the chassis. So right now it's using a chamfer mill to cut some chamfers to accept hardware.
Fulton calls his product Tesabas, which is an acronym for Tim Saves Backs.
We're wiring this one up, and it should be assembled by the end of the week.
The machine is a folding belt designed to operate in the belly of an aircraft like a Boeing 737 or an Airbus A320. Unfolded, it's 20 feet long with 8 independent conveyor belts that move your luggage from the loading door toward the center of the plane, where a ramper piles it up and secures it with a cargo net. In current practice, your luggage doesn't move down a belt inside a plane. A ramper working on their knees throws, shoves, or rolls it, and the consequences can be painful and often chronic back injuries. Tsabas is not exactly flying out the door. Fulton had to advocate for his product in a commercial environment where taking care of the people who load planes is a harder sell than passenger amenities like streaming Wi-Fi. Still, there are believers, and Fulton has traveled the world to put Tsabas in front of them, and now it's paying off.
These are sold to a equipment supplier to airlines. So we actually met this guy when we were at the expo in Paris last year. And he was with the purchaser from Malaysian Air. And the purchaser was very impressed and pushed this guy to purchase for them to send it over.
Fulton has 3 beta versions in circulation in various countries. As we spoke, one was being shipped from Brazil to Miami. Another had just been delivered in Sweden. Surprisingly, the North American market, even his former employer, Alaska Airlines, hasn't shown much interest. There's little reason to doubt Fulton, who was a ramper for 38 years, when he says the U.S. airline industry is slow to adopt. If Tsabas succeeds, it will be the international market that makes it happen.
We were on a call yesterday with Argentina, the day before with Brazil. We have IAA, the Israeli Airport Authority, is interested. From Sweden, the unit is going to Spain, England, Thailand, India. So the international market, we're close to closing deals on a daily basis.
Ramper Innovation's first year of revenue was 2022. Each of these Tsabas sells for $35,000, so they're putting up numbers for this year too. But it's still a scrappy operation.
I do have a corner office, but it is in my spare bedroom.
Maury Hackett is one of 4 employees in the company and Ramper's chief operating officer, tracking everything from the company's 3 to 5 year strategy to how it manages time on the production floor. When I was last here, Hackett was in a jacket and slacks. Today, she's in work clothes, helping to assemble the product. Her background is in recreational therapy and ergonomics. She's helping to position Fulton as a thought leader in ramp safety, and she believes that safety will ultimately sell to Tsabas.
In the receptivity that Tim had in Paris by all these European companies, they're like, oh, this is incredible. And not just like, oh, this is an interesting thing. Like, let me see if I can convince the decision maker of purchasing this thing. They have the authority as the safety person, and safety is shaping things.
A crowdfunding campaign for Ramper Innovations raised over $325,000 last year. But now that he's actually putting Tsabas into production, Fulton believes his company is turning over a new chapter. He envisions his folding belt technology used in trucking, warehousing, and even cruise ships. Like a lot of entrepreneurs, he did not think it would be this hard, but he's in it for the duration.
It does get stressful, but it's still enjoyable, and I think believing in what we're doing makes a big difference.
In the meantime, Fulton will continue cultivating international sales and stay focused. What's in front of us right now, he says, is getting these units built and getting more sold. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Alaska Pacific University offers an education as an adventure in living and learning. Students are the core of APU, representing the aspirations and collective wisdom of our community. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Alaska's Indigenous heritage while offering a unique and powerful educational experience. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
In December, the native village of Kotzebue received $140,000 from the federal government to expand the monitoring of algal blooms in the region. Scientists say it's an emerging problem and the funding couldn't come soon enough. Amid a changing Arctic and warming waters, they believe toxic blooms may proliferate in the region. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
12 years ago, Alex Whiting noticed something odd in the water around Kotzebue.
There was a chartreuse green thick slick that was in front of Kotzebue and also in Illivac Bay. And nobody had seen that kind of a thick, bright green slick before.
Whiting is the environmental program director for the native village of Kotzebue. After the initial discovery, he reached out to colleagues at East Carolina University, who identified the pink, bright, green slick as an algal bloom. Algal blooms occur when there is an excessive amount of cyanobacteria, which is also known as blue-green algae. The next year, Whiting says he collected more samples and reached out to several researchers who identified two species of cyanobacteria that had not been documented in the region.
Aphanizomenon is one of them, and Anabaena or Dolichospermum is the other one. And we did notice that there was, in fact, toxins.
Whiting says cyanobacteria isn't necessarily a threat. He says blue-green algae have been on the planet for around 3.5 billion years and were some of the first life forms. In fact, Whiting says they may be the reason we have oxygen in the atmosphere.
Although they're one of the least known species by your average person, arguably they're one of the most important species on the planet.
Whiting says that toxins are a byproduct of cyanobacteria. And in large numbers, these toxins can kill fish and wildlife. In humans, the toxins can accumulate in the liver and may cause other health problems. The blooms have even been documented to change the migratory patterns of fish species. Whiting says there's still a lot of unknowns when it comes to the rapid growth of the algae, which is why monitoring is so important. This winter, now over a decade since Whiting's initial discovery of the bloom, the Kotzebue tribe secured $140,000 in federal funds to monitor the phenomenon. Whiting says the funds will allow scientists to study and test bacteria levels locally. Ajit Subramaniam is a microbial oceanographer and professor. He joined Whiting in Kotzebue in late March. He says the increase in blue-green algae is the result of climate change.
As your listeners probably only know too well, this is a system that is changing quite rapidly. And the emerging threats from things like harmful algal blooms, cyanotoxins, are one of many manifestations of the change that's going on.
Subramaniam says the algal blooms in the Northwest Arctic are oddly similar to outbreaks along the Mississippi River, which are fed from runoff from industrial fertilizers.
Both of them are caused by the excess presence of nutrients. It is just that in the case of the Mississippi, it is through direct human activity, whereas here it is more likely to be a case where it's a thawing of the tundra that is starting to release these excess nutrients and causing this.
Subramaniam says there are different types of bacterial blooms, and there have been new species recently identified in the Bering and Chukchi Seas. He says the cyanobacteria found in Kotzebue Sound is somewhat unique because it's occurring at a higher latitude in areas where salt water and fresh water mix. However, due in part to warming Arctic temperatures, he says any open water in the tundra can contain cyanobacteria. Both Subramaniam and Whiting emphasize that potential algal blooms are not a reason to avoid subsistence or native food sources. Whiting says he has not yet observed levels that were alarming or that could kill fish or wildlife. But, he says, continued monitoring of Kotzebue's water is important. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
A man with strong ties to Gambell and the Kenai Peninsula has been recognized for his commitment and dedication to Native cultural pride and identity. KNOM's Greg Knight reports about how this young Indigenous leader has been spotlighted for his good work in the state.
Sam Schimmel, 23, is an Indigenous youth advocate who is Siberian Yupik and Kenaitse Indian. Schimmel was the inaugural recipient Friday of the Autumn Apoc Ridley Award, given by the Alaska Native Heritage Center in recognition of his love for Indigenous culture and ways of life and the work he's done in sharing Native values. He spent his childhood listening to and learning from elders. His undergraduate college years at Stanford University focused on earth systems and public policy. He's currently a law student at Georgetown University and plans to work for the Alaska Native Justice Center later this year. Schimmel says listening to elders as a youth was one of the most important touchstones in his life.
They're the ones who really taught me how to be Native. They're the ones who instilled in me the promise of reciprocity that our communities are based on, the idea that our elders will teach us how to live and how to be. In exchange, when we grow up, we will take care of our elders and we will pass down that knowledge onto our children so that they will take care of us.
He says that the survival of Native culture in Alaska continues because of that promise of reciprocity.
That promise and that core belief is what keeps our Native communities together. That's what has brought us through to where we are. That is what has allowed us to thrive for tens of thousands of years in some of the harshest places on Earth that we call our home.
In 2021, Schimmel coordinated Operation Fish Drop, a youth-led initiative to provide food security for Native families and elders during the historic statewide drop in salmon runs and the COVID-19 pandemic. He reached out to ask ANHC for help distributing more than 12,000 pounds of salmon to the Alaska Native community. The answer was an immediate yes.
Some of the greatest stories that you'll ever hear are told around a table set with Indigenous food. So when it comes to our assistance food, it isn't necessarily so much about the nutrition that it provides, but about the cultural responsibility that is instilled in that food. The knowledge that, you know, somebody in your community went out or somebody in another community went out and caught that animal in the way that's been passed down between generations since time immemorial and has brought that into a home.
The food provided was traditional, nutrient-rich, and tailored to subsistence diets. 25-pound boxes of sockeye salmon were given to elders, individuals, and families. The award is named after the late Autumn Apoc Ridley, a former ANHC intern and Alaska Native gamer, who first learned the Alaska Native games at ANHC and went on to become a world record holder in numerous Native games. Reporting in Nome, I'm Greg Knight.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Riley Board in Juneau, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Rachel Cassandra in Petersburg, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Greg Knight in Nome. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.